Hello once again and welcome to this latest edition of Rainer Hirsch's Proms in the Pub, my twice weekly and quite cheeky podcast about the BBC proms held at the Albert Hall. We hope you're enjoying the series and ask you to kindly subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Also, send us any feedback, which you can do via www.promsinthepub.co.uk. You wouldn't believe how happy we are to hear from you. Thanks also for fighting your way through the adverts which crop up when listening to this podcast, most particularly as soon as you press go. As I've been at pains to point out on previous editions, Proms in the Pub is neither commissioned nor sanctioned by the BBC. In fact, we're nothing to do with anyone, which is another way of saying that no one is paying us to lovingly handcraft these transmissions. Then why bother, say our friends and partners. Good point, we say. We can't even quote the famous words of mountaineer George Mallory, who, when questioned by a reporter why he wanted to climb Everest, replied, "Because it's there." As well, our particular Everest wasn't there. We're just doing this because. Incidentally, Mallory and his producer, climbing partner, Sandy Irving, basically disappeared without trace halfway up or halfway down the mountain, no one is quite sure. And we have every reason to expect the same will happen to our podcast, but we still don't care. All that is by way of saying, please bear with us and our advertisements. We need and are grateful for our advertisers' support and encourage you to go out and do whatever it is they want you to do, because if they're happy, we're happy. Yes, here endeth the first lesson. Now, one thing the proms is not always stuff you know. Mixed in there are pieces which have been written in the recent past, some of which are receiving their very, very first performance. Now, please don't turn off at the thought of a load of jingle-jangle nonsense that you don't quite get. Take a moment to open your ears to something which can end up being the most fun part of the concert. Music which hasn't been through the mangle, years of pontificating experts, but which is presented raw and direct to you. Granted, you probably won't leave whistling the tunes, but as we all know with classical music, that takes time and repeating in any case. But you might be left with an overall pleasing impression, and that is a start. A few of the pieces we've had so far in this season: Sally Beamish's Hive, a four-movement piece based on a year in the life of bees; Hilde Gudnadottir's The Fact of the Matter. Hilde Gudnadottir, I practiced that by the way, is the woman behind some of the most acclaimed film and gaming music of the recent past. She wrote, for example, the soundtrack to the Batman prequel Joker and the video game score for Battlefield 2042. Yes, I can't stop playing it. Probably like you, when I was growing up, gaming music was just the beep and boop you got when your paddle came into contact with the ball in Pong. But things have moved on. Then on the 28th of July, Jennifer Walsh's The Site of an Investigation, which involved wrapping objects in Amazon packaging, a stuffed giraffe, and a big pyramid of plastic cups being knocked over, said it could be fun. You can't help smiling even at the description in the programme. The Site of an Investigation ranges wildly over our contemporary predicament, taking in microplastics, Facebook likes, grief, precarity — that's the state of being precarious, by the way — interplanetary colonisation, artificial intelligence, and loss. So not much then. You can hear all this stuff wherever you are in the world by finding BBC Sounds and guiding your way to Radio 3. All the concerts are available on demand there until October the 10th. But what's it like writing a piece for the proms? The last night, even. Hearing something you've quietly jotted down in your music room brought to life in front of all those thousands, nay, hundreds of thousands listening at home. What's it like sitting in the hall and enduring the grumpy reactions of people wishing your sonic exploration of everything could just be over so they could get back to the symphony they know they like? We need a tame composer, don't we? One who's been there and done that and got the scars to prove it. Enter the charming, the erudite, and the infinitely good Roxana Pumphrey. Let me go back to the beginning, if okay. You will, because...
Doctor.
Thank you very much. Please tell me about your child. No, Roxana, your name suggests it. Your lot, they're not from around here, are they?
No. And I thought I was just half Polish and half English. But not long ago, I did one of those ancestral DNA tests, and I've discovered that I'm 14 point something percent Iberian
Wow.
and 1% Egyptian.
Fantastic.
So I'm so excited because I've got all these different nationalities in me, and I think it kind of explains why I'm such a musical nomad.
Yeah.
But my, you know, I think I am quite Polish mostly.
Your dad, he come from Poland in 1954?
Exactly, had a very dramatic escape
Yeah.
from KGB agents whilst on a conducting tour in Zurich
Wow.
and arrived here with absolutely nothing in
Right.
1954, except a soon-to-be ex-wife.
Right. Because funny enough, I'm sounding like a sort of colonel, you know, I knew your father, strangely.
Did you? Wow, how
But,
come?
well, he wasn't exactly, you know, somebody would come around to my house for tea, but I was involved with Richmond Concert Society, and that he was president of Richmond Concert Society for 1,000 years.
Wow.
And I also knew your uncle, Toby Jessel.
Oh, who I miss so much.
Yeah, your mum's brother. Yeah, he was a great guy. And I knew him very well, actually.
Oh.
And you know, your you I think you've, is it true to say you've become more Polish since your dad died? Is that a thing, do you think?
Well, I'd be really interested to know why you asked that, and then I'll tell you.
Well, I'll ask it because our stories are not entirely dissimilar. He says, Rainer Wolfgang Hirsch. My dad obviously didn't have, you know, didn't escape from the KGB in Zurich, but he did escape the Nazis in 1939. He wasn't Jewish, but his father was.
Right.
And his father's brother ended up in Auschwitz. So there was good reason. And there's that to it. And I am imposing my story slightly on you, but I also noticed that, for example, there was in 2016 a referendum in this country.
There was, and very swiftly, I got my Polish citizenship, which actually I've always wanted, but it sort of propelled me into doing it a bit more quickly. And so I'm very proud now to have dual nationality.
Yeah.
I'm also very ashamed to say that I've been trying to learn Polish for 30 years now, and I still can't speak it because it's the most difficult language ever. But I will keep trying.
Well, no, hang on a second. You do yourself a disservice because there's so you've written, you know, commemorative pieces for Poland. You work with Polish artists, the whole thing. So, you know, clearly you're better than you know,
Well,
you give yourself credit for.
I'm trying. I understand a lot more than I can speak, but it's
Yeah.
the grammar that really lets me down.
Yeah. So, well, that's the way of it, isn't it? But I'm sure they, you know, they're pleased for anything. And of course, so can I? I know you don't like to talk about politics, but the
Sorry.
referendum and the 2017, could they in any way be related, your nationality and all that?
Oh. Absolutely,
Hmm.
absolutely. And it was just one of those things that I've been wanting to do all my adult life. But it's just when Brexit happens, I was so appalled and ashamed and depressed about it, and desperately wanted to cling on to Europe and being European, that was what I did. It just propelled me into getting my citizenship, and I was very lucky I got it very quickly.
This is of no relevance, but you're Catholic. Yeah,
Mm-hmm.
you are, because much of your music is celebrates or Catholic or sorry, celebrates Christian vocal music, at least in your early stages. That's the case.
Absolutely. And I would say about 70% of what I do is Christian liturgical music, but very excitingly, I've just written my first Jewish liturgical piece for the Liberal Jewish Synagogue. And I'd love to work in other faiths as well, so we'll see.
Composer.
Yes.
Pretty odd job, isn't it?
It's very strange. And when I was in my teens, if you'd asked me what I wanted to do, I wanted to be an ambulance driver.
Yeah, where did it all go wrong?
glad to know that it's still at the back of my mind. And there are still days when I'm sort of looking at a blank piece of manuscript paper and nothing's happening, where I'm thinking, right, am I too old to start as an ambulance driver?
At what point did people stop asking you, and what do you really do?
Oh, do you know, they don't. They never have. However, they've often been very surprised, particularly at concerts, when they've seen that I was the contemporary composer in the programme, because they were expecting someone older and greyer and possibly maler. And and it's really funny because, you know, quite often I sit in audiences as an incognito composer, and you hear all sorts of fantastic comments like, oh, why do they always have to put a modern piece of music in the programme? The classic one was when I was in my early 20s, and it was Hampton Choral Society, and I had this new piece. I was really nervous. It was my first proper professional commission. And just as my piece was about to start, someone said behind me, oh no, it's Roxana Panufnik, not Anjay Panufnik. So I had a lovely time when I got up to go and take my bow at the end, and then I came back to my seat and I smiled angelically at them.
Now, Andrew, we've got to say that Andrew Panufnik was your dad. Mm. We didn't mention that. And he was the one that escaped the KGB.
He did.
And he was a composer, of course, and a conductor. Conducted the CBSO, City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, for a couple of years. So a very noted, you know, musician in his day, and had, you know, a celebrated, well, wartime duet with Witold Lutoslawski and other people.
He sure did, yeah.
That reaction to the new, the contemporary composer, the contemporary composition. You have written, well, you've had two pieces performed at the Proms. The second was a commission, have I got that right? Which is for the last night.
Yes.
The first one doesn't seem so auspicious now in our current setting, which was a piece called Three Paths to Peace, very laudable, and it was performed by the World Orchestra for Peace, conducted by Valery Gergiev, not known at this current moment for, you know, those predispositions. He's more famous for his relationship to Vladimir Putin and the fact that his career has kind of fallen apart, basically because he won't renounce, or well, his friendship with Putin is very prominent. He's been booted out of his position in Munich and places like that. So how do you feel about that now when you think about that?
Well, wanting to believe the best in people, I wonder if Putin has something over him. I mean, who would ally themselves willingly with Putin, especially at the moment? But it's interesting because that first prom that I had with the World Orchestra for Peace and him was incredibly exciting. It was in 2014, and it was actually, there was a huge amount going on about my dad at that time. It was his centenary. But we'd done this piece with the World Orchestra for Peace in Jerusalem, appropriately, because it was based on the story of Abraham in the Bible being asked by God to sacrifice his son Isaac as a test of his faith, which appears in all three Abrahamic monotheistic faiths. And so I created a sort of music analogy for this and used elements from chant from each of the faiths to create this very programmatic piece. And it was originally a violin concerto called Abraham. And when World Orchestra for Peace asked for an overture and I didn't have time to write one, I said, would you mind if I reworked this for you into an overture? And they were delighted because they were going to perform in Jerusalem. So it was very appropriate. And actually, it was the most incredible trip. That was in 2008. And I was so thrilled and excited it was going to be done at the Proms. And it was the most wonderful experience. And there is nothing like a Proms audience. And walking out on that stage. And it's so exciting and such a privilege. It was also a little bit strange because in 2014, Gergiev was already in trouble for allying himself with Putin about Putin's invasion of Crimea. So there was a lot of bad stuff going around in the press and on social media about Gergiev. And they actually had to implement some quite strict security arrangements for the prom. So there were two beefy minders on either side of the stage and a sort of cordon across the stage so people couldn't get up onto it. And because of that, when it came to me going to take my bow, I couldn't just sort of come down onto the stage and do it. I had to be taken out by somebody from the BBC and walk all around the back of it. And I was really worried about this because I was absolutely convinced that people anyway would have had enough of applauding by the time I got to the stage. And I voiced my concerns and they said, no, it'll be fine. And I said, well, you are going to tell the maestro, aren't you? And they said, oh, yes, he'll know. So anyway, the time comes, very exciting, fabulous performance by World Orchestra for Peace and Gergiev. And then it takes me a good 3 or 4 minutes to get round to the back and underneath into the side of the stage from where the dressing rooms are. And there's Gergiev waiting in the wings. Where were you? I was looking for you everywhere. And showed me out like in a really grumpy way. And then suddenly it was so funny because then as soon as he walked on stage, who's all smiles? Well, he doesn't really smile, does he? But he's sort of, you know, looking a bit happier than he usually does. But it was slightly bizarre experience because of that whole kind of security issue. And he obviously wasn't best pleased with me, but I still loved it.
I thought you were going to end that story by saying that I had to take the applause for Tchaikovsky for Symphony at the end of the programme. No, but I mean, that's kind of speaks of the enormous, I mean, it's like there's a huge machine, all these cogs are whirring away. And you were right to ask, you know, have you told the maestro? Because, well, you know, there's only one way to tell the maestro is probably to tell the maestro yourself. Were you there for the rehearsal?
I was, yeah. Yes, I was. And that's when... And it was at the end of that rehearsal, just as I was leaving, that they told me the arrangements for taking my bow. So I didn't really have a chance to talk to him about it.
Presumably, well, let's just ask this question. What's it like when you hear... Was that the first time you'd ever heard that played live, that music? Played?
No, it'd been done at in Jerusalem, which was incredible, because the piece starts with a sort of quasi... call to prayer. I didn't obviously use a real one, a real Muslim call to prayer, because obviously that would have been offensive. I consulted a Sunni imam and a Shia imam, and it was decided in the end that I should, they suggested that I listen to lots of calls to prayer and create one of my own, which I did. So anyway, the piece starts with that, and then over that comes some Christian church bells sounding. And on the afternoon of the concert in Jerusalem, me and some of the people in the orchestra went and stood on the top of Mount of Olives. I mean, it is incredible to be there because you've been brought up all your life hearing about this place and it's in the Bible and you've been picturing your head, and it's just extraordinary to be there. And we heard a call to prayer and then some Christian church bells ringing. It was absolutely incredible. It was such an experience. So it was very exciting. And in Jerusalem, we couldn't have had a more sort of mixed faith audience. I mean, there were all sorts of people there. There were Orthodox priests and some nuns, and, you know, there was people of all faiths and none there. It was incredible. Did you see that I did? All faiths and none.
I like that. Yeah. I'm going to use that if it's going rough.
Yeah, any gig. If you're desperate.
I suppose what I was getting at with that question about hearing the music actually performed, so that happens at some point. Yeah. It happened in Jerusalem, maybe, where it happened in the proms. What's that like? You know, you've been working on this thing, Can I ask, do you use like, do you write on manuscript paper? Do you use the computer?
So I use this lovely piano here, this baby Bechstein that my father used to compose on. And I usually sort of sketch out, I usually do harmonies first. Harmonies are my main and most important thing. I create a harmonic progression and then build other things over and underneath it. And then I start putting it onto music notation software quite quickly, because I have this bizarre thing. I have this kind of rhythmic dyslexia where I can hear rhythm, I can appreciate it, and I can think it, but I can't do it. So I can never conduct. I can't for the life of me dance, and I can't play anything in time either. So I really need that software to play back what I think I've written to make sure it's right. So that's very important. But I always hear it in my head first. So there's a lovely point at a rehearsal when you're first hearing it, and you go, yes, that's what I was originally thinking, because it does get supplanted by the software, which is horrible. But the other thing that's really bizarre is when you have a new piece being played for the first time, it's like they're reading your mind.
Ooh.
It's really spooky, because you've had this music in your head and suddenly everybody else is doing it. It's like, and it's also your innermost emotions and feelings, so you feel quite vulnerable. Yeah. Well, I do anyway.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre. It takes a certain amount of courage, I think.
So I also need to elaborate, you know, what music software, people who've never used it or you know aren't involved in writing dots down for people to play, might not appreciate. It's like a word processor, but for music, essentially.
Exactly.
You see
that.
A score. There are the lines that everybody's used to. You can actually place the dots in the lines, and it's very clever. It can make sure you don't mistake. It's like put too many notes in any given bar, and then you kind of press a button, and it kind of plays it back to you. And in a sort of better these days, it's really quite good, you know, but you can kind of hear it in advance.
Yes, you can. It's not bad. Before I started using this kind of software in about 1995. And before
is it
then,
Sibelius?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure whether I was allowed to mention
it. Listen, we don't care. It is. I use Sibelius too. Actually, they were the first kind of ones, and I used it from then about as well. And then they went, of course, now you have to rent the sodding thing. So I can say sodding thing as well.
Yeah, okay, great.
We don't care what we say.
Steady. So, yes, no, it's amazing. So in the days before music notation software, it would take me a whole afternoon to write, like, one page of this orchestral opera score.
Yeah.
Because you're aligning every simultaneous note on anything up to sort of 30, 40 staves. And it took forever. And I used to get terrible pain in my hand from it. It was awful. Now, like on Sibelius, it takes, well, almost like, I don't know, 5% of the time it would take.
Okay, but so you, nevertheless, there is a difference between that and this kind of experience. And it's that's interesting. You know, you hear this thing brought to life in 3D with real breathing musicians, except for the violas, doing it for you.
Especially the violas, I would say. It is an extraordinary experience. And I often catch myself sitting in a concert if there's a big sort of choir and a big orchestra there, and I sort of suddenly I'm kind of 10 years old again, thinking, gosh, this is so grown up. And it's brilliant. I love it.
So that was stage one. Now the second thing that happened was in 2018.
Yes.
Songs of Darkness, Dreams of Light.
Yes.
And that was a BBC commission.
It was indeed for the last night of the proms, and I can't tell you how exciting it was and how agonising it was to have to keep it secret for so long, because you find out about it sort of 18 months before it's due to happen, but you're not allowed to tell anybody, otherwise you have to kill them. And
Messy. It's very messy.
It's very messy. And then, and you have to wait for the sort of proms announcement sort of 3 months before they start. So that was very exciting. And I'm very proud of myself that I didn't tell anybody. I told my husband. I told my husband, and my publishers obviously knew, but that was incredibly exciting. What a gig! That is the best gig you can get, a commission for the last night of the proms, and it was my 50th birthday year, and it was just the icing on the cake. It was so exciting.
So you wait 18 months, and do they say? I mean. What do they say about it?
They just said that they would like a piece which was for the BBC Symphony Orchestra, BBC Singers and BBC Symphony Orchestra Chorus.
That's all of them, isn't it? There's no others, basically.
No, there's a whole thing all the BBC stuff.
Yeah.
But the Symphony Chorus part had to be independent of the BBC Singers part, but it also needed to work together. And so that was quite a challenge because the chorus obviously is like 100, over 100 singers, and the BBC Singers is like 24. So that was interesting, you know, finding a way of balancing that. But of course, obviously the BBC Singers, because they're professional, wonderful professional singers, they also have a lot of training and a lot more volume. So that was very handy. So I created something that had a sort of dialogue between the two choirs.
And it commemorated the end of First World War. That was the centenary of that. So
yes, it was a beautiful poem by Isaac Rosenberg. And so it's a piece that had a Jewish text. So I drew from Jewish chant on that. And also beautiful The Prophet by Gibran, Maronite Syriac, so Middle Eastern Christian musical influences and chant, which is just so beautiful. So I mixed that and then brought the sort of Islamic element was Sufi structure and Sufi rhythms through to it. So again, I was making this point about us all believing in the same one God and having all these things in common.
Yeah. You have actually got to do this work. It's your job. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be entirely indiscreet, but I mean,
How much do I get paid?
How do they pay you? How do they work that out?
All right, so it's really easy. It's on a per minute basis.
Right.
So so there's a certain amount per minute you'd expect to be paid for a chamber piece, and it would be a bigger amount if it was an orchestral piece, or a smaller amount if it might just be, you know, a small a cappella choral piece or a song or something. So there are various rates, and then that per minute rate is worked out according to your experience and how senior you are.
Well, that's great. I mean, your output is so interesting and varied, and you know, you focused on specific things as we've talked about. But one thing I was wondering is where you get the names from, where they crop up. And before you answer that, I've actually got some names of pieces. I want us to play a game.
Okay.
Which is called I Wrote That. There'll be some sort of sting, musical sting there, but we'll put that on in post.
Okay.
I'm going to say the names of pieces, and you've just got to say I wrote that or I didn't write that.
Okay.
Or you can say I kind of wrote that.
Okay.
So, Roxana Punufnik, are you ready to play?
I'm ready.
I wrote that. Okay, first one, Cats the Musical.
I wish I had wrote that.
Okay. The Crocodile and the Monkey.
I did write that.
What was that?
It was one of my beastly tales.
Very good. The Frog and the Nightingale.
Yes, that was another beastly tale.
2002, that was. Soprano, mezzo-soprano, baritone and orchestra, that was.
Yeah.
The Wasp and the Picnic.
I so did not write that.
Down the Rabbit Hole.
Yes, that was me.
Oh, sorry, you've got to answer in the correct...
Sorry, I wrote that.
Yes, I wrote that, exactly. Otherwise, you don't get the point. The Digital Stethoscope and the Bear.
I incorporated that.
I kind of wrote that. Tell us how you kind of wrote that.
Okay. So, I was writing a piece called Heartfelt for the Sacconi Quartet, and I'd just been reading a book about the demise of dancing bears in Bulgaria. And I really wanted to write a musical piece about them. I was so moved by their plight and their rescue. And Heartfelt was about the heart and heartbeats. And I wondered whether a bear's heartbeat sounded different to a human one's. And then I searched and searched everywhere. You would think that you would find a bear's heartbeat somewhere on the internet, YouTube, somewhere.
There's some loony out there that's done it, no.
Yes, nothing. Yeah. And so I wrote to every zoo and zoological society in the UK, and they completely ignored me and obviously thought I was completely crazy. And finally, in desperation, I put a post on Facebook saying, does anybody know any zoo vets? And not only did a cellist friend of mine, Richard May, live next door to Bristol Zoo, he teaches music to the zoo director's children. So he introduced me, and within a few days, zoo vet rang me and said, you are so in luck, because in 10 days' time, we're doing a small surgical procedure on a European brown bear, which is exactly the right kind of bear. And you'll appreciate that you can only listen to a bear's heartbeat when it's not awake.
Yes.
And I said, great, great, great. And she said, but unfortunately, I can't invite you into the operating theatre to listen to his heartbeat. So what we need is a digital stethoscope that I can record it on. But we don't have one. So we were sort of ringing around various zoos to see if we could borrow somebody's. No one had one.
Then. Amazon.
Well,
Amazon.
I did look on Amazon, and Amazon there wasn't Prime. One.
There wasn't one.
No. So anyway, Michelle Zuvet found one somewhere, and I went 50-50 with Bristol Zoo, and I'd like that to be in the Guinness World Book of Records as the most obscure use of a commission deposit.
how much is a digital stethoscope?
It was about £380.
Hell. And is it ever going to be used again?
Yes, they are using it all the time.
Is it known as the Roxana Punafnik
digital? It jolly well should be, shouldn't it?
All right. On with I wrote that. Advert stings for the 2022 Qatar World Cup.
I didn't write that.
Letter from America.
I didn't write that.
Letters from Burma 2004.
I did write that.
I'm afraid that's a loss. That's a point down. Letters from Burma 2004 for oboe and string quartet. Yeah, you did write that.
So that
was what I was referring to. Rimsky-Korsakov's The Flight of the Bumblebee. Think carefully, Roxana.
Okay, I kind of wrote that.
Yes, is the correct answer.
Thank you.
So how did you kind of write that?
Okay, so a wonderful cellist, Hannah Chang, who's now actually a conductor, wanted me to do a sort of wacky arrangement of that for her in chamber orchestra. So I did that for her. And it involves a certain amount of acting by the double bass player. That's all I'll say.
Okay, all right, fine. Yeah, that's always troublesome because, you know, they're usually troubled in the head. Laughing Song.
Oh, I did write that.
Yes. That was one of the early ones, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Way back. Whew.
And that might be consigned to a bottom drawer somewhere, probably. But anyway, go on.
How Deep Is Your Love by the Bee Gees. Think. How deep is your love, but so strong is his love, 2007.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
I wrote that. Yeah, yeah.
An opera based on an 18th century harpsichord score arranged and orchestrated for steel band.
I kind kind of wrote that.
Okay, yes.
So there were steel pans in it, but there was also a harpsichord, which is an interesting combination, but it worked. It worked. And I just reconstructed this 18th century dialogue opera, as you do for an opera festival in Barbados.
So the final question in I Wrote That is the contestant arrival music for the second series of Love Island.
I didn't write that.
You have scored, after that round, full marks, Roxana. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Thank you. What's my prize?
You win an appearance on Proms in the Pub.
Thank you.
Well, listen, it has been such a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, bless you. It's great to meet you.
Roxana Penafleet. Actually, those of you paying attention will have noticed that Roxana didn't, in fact, score full pints in the inaugural and final edition of I Wrote That. But, well, she's such a lovely person, I didn't have the heart to say. That interview in Southwest London, by the way, also involved producer Julian accidentally, well, that's what he claimed, scooping up Roxana's house keys on the way out, only realising once he had driven almost all the way back home to Brighton, which is roughly an hour and a half with no traffic and about a day and a half if there is, then having to do a complete other round trip to bring them back that evening. Yes, we do need those advertisers. Meanwhile, on Friday the 22nd of July, we had music for royal occasions, including Handel's Water music arranged by Hamilton Harty. Hearing this and not wanting to be outdone, our regular special guest, Harry the Piano, went to his keyboard to prove, as if we didn't know, that anything Hamilton Harty could do, he could do better. This is the result, his jazzy water music. And listen out for a bit of Hallelujah Chorus thrown in for good measure. Jacques Lussier, eat your heart out. Until next time, thanks for listening.